My sister and I went to school. People getting killed. Oh. Fucking screwdrivers back then was just normal.
Oh, God.
I'm not going to start a family until I'm financially stable. I'm not going to ever put my children through this. This is shit.
My name is Mark Rolt.
And I love struggle. It makes us the best version of ourselves. But I can promise you, my friend, should you wish to plug in and truly build out who the fuck you are as a man, you've got this.
Literally on the verge of bankruptcy. We're bankrupt because I appointed him as a manager. He didn't rip me off. I was just stupid to believe. And like, stop this nonsense of being the victim. Everyone today wants to be the victim. It justifies your incapabilities. You know, my wife decided to end the marriage, which is completely fine. It's her choice. I can't be an easy person to live with. Being conscious of my daughter was a tough one. Some very dark days and some things I'm not proud of. Throughout it all, there was an inner knowing that I'd come out of it.
What's an activity or a strategy to get back to presence?
It's your friends. And we've all got that person.
Like, I've recently gone through a pretty tough time. So hard to just go, I'm going to show up today and I'm going to make the calls. How do you pull yourself out of that?
I start with having a very big reason why. If the why is big enough, it'll pull you through. Shit's falling apart at home. My personal life's in a fucking mess. But I'm on. This is my fucking time.
Yeah, we've got a guest on the podcast today. That's your why.
That's the why, brother.
Mate, holy smokes. We're fucking... This one's going to be an energetic podcast, and I hope we can get the emotions out of this one today, because we're sitting across a gentleman who's worth over $100 million, in excess of 1,200 investment properties, has done a lot, not only in terms of entrepreneurship and wealth building, but also impacting people's lives through education and training. So today we're blessed to interview someone in his own house, and I'd love for you to tell the story about how you purchased this house. But today we've got Mark Rolton, and I'm super excited and passionate for today. So Mark, thank you for joining us, mate. And I really want to get some insights into how we can help not only build ourselves from an entrepreneurship view, but also the real parts about life, which people don't talk about, which is when we get hit in the face, how do we overcome that? So
yeah,
today's going to be a fucking big one.
Yeah, sure. Well, firstly, I think you're doing a great thing. You know, I think that your motivations are pure and they're right. Yeah, they're wholesome. So, look, the conversation of, you know, taking hits, I mean, it's like any famous boxer, isn't it? It's not sort of how many hits you can take. I think it's more about how you get off the canvas. And I think that's someone's will. You know, I believe that you and I all need to go through the furnace to come out a better quality of steel. But no one enjoys it. Right? No one likes the fucking heat. It's intensive and it's not for everybody. But that furnace, man, is so essential to you and I arriving as men, as people. So I look, you know, and it sounds a bit sort of philosophical, but I tend to look for the challenges of life now as just opportunities. And I think that's a measured entrepreneur. We don't look at sort of, oh, that fucking bar's so high, or this is going to be tough. It's like, bring it. Let's embrace it. Let's look for the trouble. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think as you mature as a businessman, as a business person, woman, whatever, you definitely look to the horizon for those challenges, because where those big challenges are is the greatest opportunity in terms of money, right? Go solve problems. That's what entrepreneurs do. But I think with that, you've got to have a steel-like, you know, tenacity about you. You know, it's so easy to get ahead when things are going well. You know, everyone wants to win, and you just see it fucking plastered across, you know, all forms of SM these days. But the real conversation is just, how do you show up when things aren't going well? And we all have bad days, but what are you going to do about that?
When you say we have to go through the furnace to come out the other side better, and you know, look for those harder times because it's going to build us. I get that in terms of a business sense, but what happens when it hits you in terms of a personal sense? Because you don't want to be going out looking for issues in your personal life, like, for example, a breakup or something like that. What happens then?
That is good. You probably don't go looking for it. I would agree with you. But you recognize it as an opportunity. Okay. You know, someone close to you suicides, passes away. You know, some major events of life happen to you, right? But you embrace them. It's like, okay, this is a part of the fucking journey. You know, it's not about being weak. It's not about sort of reducing yourself or diluting yourself. It's like, who the fuck do I need to be in spite of this? Does that make sense?
How do you do that in the moment? Because I know I've recently gone through a pretty tough time personally, and it's so hard to just go, I'm going to show up today and I'm going to make the calls. Yeah. I'm going to show up today, I'm going to do my appointments and be fully focused. How do you pull yourself out of that?
Yeah, that's great. They're the tough questions. I agree. I start with having a very big reason why. You know, when I think the why surmounts the trouble in front of you, the problems in front of you, the disaster in front of you, if the why is big enough, it'll pull you through. And that's where you and I get lost. We get caught in the head noise. We get caught in the gyrations of life. We get caught in, you know, their opinion of you, or this wasn't fair, or this is what happened, versus who the fuck do I need to show up as? What's that man that's already there? What are the qualities and traits? How do I demonstrate those? Does that make sense?
Makes complete sense.
You look at the call list and you're like, shit's falling apart at home. My personal life's in a fucking mess. But I'm on. I'm on now. This is my fucking time.
How do you build a why in that situation?
I think the why takes time. I really do, Dan. I think that the why is something you want to carefully construct. You know, it does. It's a work in progress. It's a WIP.
Yep.
But I'd like to think that every one of us has, you know, a dream, something big instilled within us. Because that's how we rise, man. You know, there's only greats that are chasing something down. It's a dream. It's a reason. It's an aspiration. It's world peace. They're hunting something. True. And I think it's upon us to really drill into that. Get specific. You can't generalize there either. Oh, I want a new car. Well, there's 8 billion people that probably want that too, right? What is it? What color is it? What model? How are we going to go fucking get it? And when that why starts to formulate and it starts to sort of become bigger, becomes real, then all of a sudden there is buy-in. And it, to me, my experience of, you know, my career, my journey so far, there's always those moments of doubt, man. But it's about which voice is going to win. Does that make sense?
It does.
It doesn't go away. You can be fucking super wealthy, rich. Those questions and doubts will always remain. But what voice comes to the front? If the voice is, why, I'm getting that, this is going to happen, you fucking watch me, then it feels like everything else falls away. Does that make more sense?
It does. Has your why changed over time?
Of course. Absolutely.
If it has...
And it should, by the way. As you mature as a man, it absolutely needs to.
So when you were starting your journey, was your why more fear-based, I need to get away from something, for example, financial stress, or was it more as a motivation?
Look, you know, early days, it should mutate. It should change. It has to. You know, look at the greats, look at the giants, look at the titans and the moguls, the magnates of the world. You know, if they're in their 60s and still hustling like they were 19, there's a problem. They haven't matured, have they?
Yeah.
If someone's got wisdom and substance and depth, their activities at 60, 70, 80s are so very different. And it's almost like the circle closes, one full revolution where they actually want to give back. That, to me, is a full revolution. That's worthwhile. That's something wholesome and fruitful. So as a young guy, man, woman, we do have very specific needs, and we're facing the immediacy of now. Mortgage, kids, school fees. That's typical. That's so normal, right? But once those basic needs are taken care of, and this is the funny thing, this is where people kind of get shit twisted, right? You don't have to earn that much to put your head above the crowd. If you think about the cost of living, it's relatively static. Yeah. Fuel's always going to be $2 or $4, $5. But if I'm earning $2 and $3 million and it's tied to CPI, who gives a fuck what fuel is? But it's only when we're in that struggle, that zone of I don't have enough, I'm still in that scarcity mindset. Yeah. If I can push beyond that and put my earnings, let's say in relative terms today, it was one and a half. You're not fucking worried about the Bowser. You don't even give a shit what it costs a trolley to fill at Coles. It's all irrelevant. But now you start to buy time. And with that time, you should have very different whys, yeah? Now I've kind of gone from the survival mode, And I'm more into the plant mode, maturation, develop a portfolio mode, then the harvest mode. Does that make sense? There are phases through that journey path. Getting me? So they have to. Of course they start out, you know, it's like crawling. We're crawling financially before we learn how to run. Yeah?
Yeah.
You don't run forever. There's a time where you can't run. At that point, you know, what are you doing with your life? What does it amount to? And that revolution should be, I believe, you'll find the greats all seem to come back to this nobility of giving. How can I help other generations? Look at Dalio. That guy drives the largest fund on the planet. It's got $1.7 trillion under management. That guy's last two decades have been nothing but legacy. He has made over 300 millionaires personally. An executive team that are worth 100 million, he's made 14 of them, worth 100 mil apiece. Now that guy goes out with fucking trophies and accolades. I get goosebumps talking about him. Yeah. That's a man. That's worth living.
Yeah, that's big time.
You're pretty big on, I've seen doing my research on man having a purpose. Can you share your experience with what's that been like for you and then what you observe with the general population? Because there's a bit of a disconnect, especially now with men's mental health.
Yeah, there is, yeah. Look, this is not a simple conversation, but let's just say for the last 40 million years, you and I were engineered in such a way that we would go out and then you and I would have to bring back something to the cave to survive. That's the way we're wired. It's our DNA. That hasn't changed. That won't change. I don't give a fuck about what genders, what colour, this, LB. Wonderful. But people without a purpose will perish. It's a given. So I don't know my purpose. No, none of us do. None of us are born with it.
Yeah, right.
But it's upon us to fossick and discover. It's up to us to dive in, delve in and say, what is this about? You know, if I hit 60, 85 years of age, what did all this amount to? What did this stand for? So it's upon us to start to discover that process. And it could be philanthropy. It could be doing something great, musician, pianist, whatever. But I think the responsibility is to drive that thought, pursue it. Because when you got purpose, man, nothing's an effort after that. You know, and you'll switch career, you'll switch trades, you'll switch pathways in life. Oh, but Mark, there's no money in it. Fuck the money. Find the passion, the money will come. But not enough people have faith to the degree to step into that.
Do you, from your experience getting into the space of real estate, making quite a substantial amount of money doing things like options, developments, etc., has that been a passion that you've monetized or was it something you did getting you out of survival mode?
Correct. People sort of think that I've got this wild passion for real estate. It never started out that way. It just wasn't. It was pure desperation. You know, I was literally on the verge of bankruptcy. I was about 11 days away from losing the whole lot, BK. And I sat with an accountant, Graham, and he said, listen, here's what you can do. This is a way through it. So I was on the edge. I was on the verge, right? But property was one of those things that I just reached for and went, okay, $5 an hour extra for my boss is never going to save me. It's not going to rescue the situation. But if I can do something where I can make 20, 25K, and that was a lot of money 17 years ago, that was a lump, right? If I make 20, 25K in one chunk, well, I can get some creditors off my back. And that's the reason I pushed into property. It's like, I know of people that do quite well out of that world. I know nothing. But if I can lean on them, stand on their shoulders, maybe I'll learn something. And that's where it began. There was a guy that I knew of that had an air conditioning business. That was his core sole operation, but did developments on the side. And he got himself into a bind. He was like, I need to do something. And I've rang him at the same time. He goes, I need to unload some stuff. And I knew of a guy that was already doing house and land packages for investors.
Wow.
And I just basically said, Brian, meet fucking Stuart. Is there something in between? And it turned out the lawyer knew exactly how to do it. That was 42 grand in a day and a half.
Oh, nice.
That changed everything, man. But I had to be willing. I had to put myself. That was a total step of faith. I'm 11 days away from fucking bankruptcy. How many people have got the stomach for that?
Yeah.
Right? You're staring down fucking failure. Got it? That ain't fucking easy, man.
Yeah.
So you obviously didn't.
That ain't easy.
Fuck no.
That's just belief. It's just like, I'll do it until, I don't give a fuck. I'll just keep getting up. Make sense? I'm trying to answer your question, but there's a lot of words that sort of describe that inner voice. You hit the camp, I don't give a fuck, kill me. I'll just keep punching me, but I'll eventually work it out. Keep swinging, I'll learn.
So
that's
so
the difference.
You weren't born with money.
No, mate, no. Very different to that.
So there's going to be a lot of listeners that don't know your story. Where did your journey start? Like, did you grow up in Gold Coast? What was family Logan. Like? And
mate, that's the Richies. That's the land of the Richies, right? No, I grew up in a place called Woodridge.
Okay.
It's not the arsehole of the world, but you can see it from there, right? But it's a nasty place and still is, man. You know, like my sister and I went to school and people getting killed, you know, shanked and fucking screwdrivers. It was not unusual.
Oh, God.
And I started to meet other people and like, what do you mean people getting stabbed at school? Yeah, a guy got a fishing knife in the gut the other day. It's like, what? So it was a bit different, right? But my parents, you know, they just had a very volatile relationship. And domestic violence back then was just normal. This is the early 80s, mid-80s. You know, you'd hear some family, some house down the street screaming. This was not unusual, man, you know, but particularly in those areas. And their relationship was just so fractured, but it all seemed to pivot from money. The arguments all began with a lack of money. It was like, there's fucking bills and you're spending this and you're doing this. So my dad was a coal miner, right? He worked underground, made good money, was just hopeless with it. So much so that he ran another business on the side and he'd work 17, 18, 19 hours, I'm sure, to get away from my mum. And she worked 7 days a week in a secondhand furniture centre and there was nothing. There was nothing. You know, you look at your sister on Saturday and say, what do you want to do? Mate, I was young. You know, I was 10, 11. And you were by yourself for the whole weekend.
Wow.
You could run amok if you wanted to, right? But, you know, there was no money. There was no money. You know, there was no such thing as let's go have fish and chips. There was none of that business. Yeah. It was just survival. So you barely saw them. And I think out of that, you know, there was that decision, I'm not going to live this way. And as I got older, into my early 20s, I remember saying to myself, and most young men have this conversation at some point, whether they realise it or not, I'm not going to start a family until I'm financially stable. And that perception among women, particularly young women, is he won't commit. It's not commit. Mm. He's fucking scared because he holds the future and starts with his wallet.
Yeah, it's true.
And that was me. It was early 20. I'm like, I'm not going to ever put my children through this. This is shit. You know, I remember my parents putting their head, each other's head through the gyp rock as a kid and smashing plates for fuck knows whatever reason. There's nothing to eat off in the morning, but they were just so aggro, right? And I think a lack of money does that. Wow. So that was, to me, that was, you know, it delineated the life that I wanted to live. It's like, I know what doesn't work. Now I'm going to make it work.
So what businesses did you go into when you started?
I left school grade 10. I became an apprentice chippy, a carpenter.
Okay.
That's kind of, you know, I had nothing else. It was like, I'm not going to stay at school. I hated school. I didn't get school. Right? It was tough. I didn't learn very well. So, yeah, became a chippy and then became a builder. Went off to TAFE, became a builder, registered builder. And then went back to TAFE, became a project manager of high rise and heavy commercial construction, Woolies and things like that. And then I went back to night school a third time and then got an OP and then started studying engineering at uni.
Yeah, okay.
And I started my building business was going quite well, But, you know, just a lack of experience and naivety, I appointed a manager back then to my construction business and he just sucked out every dollar of profit in a very clever way, a very deceptive way.
Oh, man.
There's no way I could prove it. It'd be 3 or 4 years in a court. I didn't have that kind of coin. So it basically hit the wall and that's where I was, 431 grand in debt at 22.
Wow.
You could buy a house back then, man, for 120. So wow. Do the math. Today that's like 3.8 mil. I was 22, 3.8.
Is this that time when you said you were 11 days away from bankruptcy?
Yeah, that's it.
Wow.
So you do the math, relative terms today. It's 3.5 million, 3.8 in today's money. I was 22.
Oh, man.
It was a big fucking sum. And accounts looking at me, how did this happen? Creditors looking at me, how did this happen? Yeah, well, just stupidity and trusting him. I'm responsible. That was my lack of business experience. But it was a pretty serious situation to be in, man.
Mm.
And all your mates are buying houses, settling down, having kids, and you're like, I'm three and a half in debt.
That's hardcore.
I've got to come back from this. How do I do that? And that's where I just started swinging for the fences. And property, right, I'm going to use that ladder against that wall. Let's fucking do this. And I just went like an idiot. I learned about town plans. Man, I would just sit there and read, and I was a terrible reader, terrible learner. This is the difference between poverty and rich. Okay? I'm prepared to pay that price.
Mm.
And I just physically inhaled, man, town plans. And there was one area that I knew had scope and potential. You could see it was undeveloped. It made sense.
Mm.
I drive around, go, yeah, that's obviously an opportunity. I just don't know how to package it yet.
Mm.
And I'd read the town plan. I'd stand across the counter and say, can you help me? She'd say, yeah, what do you want? I mean, a government worker, right? I had no money. And she'd turn around, she'd go, we can do this, this, and this, and this. And the LAP says this. And by the end of it, I reckon a good, 8-9 months, I had enough knowledge to be able to put something together.
Wow. Oh, Mark, it sounds like from your journey, you've gone from poor to rich. But in that time period, there's been a common sense, a common fuel.
Yep.
It's a type of diesel or petrol that's given you the power to transition and really get that car moving fast.
Yeah.
That fuel, though, was fuel out of potential traumas, fucking having to go through shit.
Yeah.
Has that type of fuel, when it burns, can burn toxic at times.
Yeah.
Has that had an impact on you personally, or
of course
burnt the engine the wrong way?
I love your metaphor. It's actually, you're actually very accurate, I think, in what you've said there. You know, when you look at the motives of trauma, things that happen, you know, this is the funny thing. We label it as a problem. We label it as an issue. We label it as, something that's happened to us, which I actually think it's a fucking gift. Straight up, it's a gift.
The struggle's the gift.
You know, like, stop this nonsense of being the victim. You watch. Everyone today wants to be the victim because it's easier. It justifies your incapabilities, right? But if I take responsibility, that fucking happened on my watch. I only went bankrupt because I appointed him as a manager. He didn't rip me off. I was just stupid to believe, and I should have had more experience and more acumen.
Mm.
Got it? Own it. If I'm not the victim, then I'm in charge of what happens next. Cool. So I've got this philosophy. Life happens for you, not to you. So when the shit goes down, the chips fall, and the trauma comes about, yes, you use that as fuel. Now, in your words, your metaphor, you know, you might say, well, yeah, it can be toxic.
I totally agree.
If you let it get the better of you, for sure. But I use it, I sort of treat it like nuclear fuel. Use it sparingly. Use it in a measured fashion. Fuck it. They said it can't be done. Watch me. One of the things I love is when people say it can't be done or you're about to fail. Fucking watch me. That's all I need. Tell me it can't be done and I'll fucking prove you wrong. And there was a lot of them. There was a lot of them. For my circle of friends that we all left school grade 10, there was a lot of that sort of talk in the room, you know. Oh, yeah, fuck that. Too hard. You work too much, all this. You won't really make it. And I remember teachers at school saying to me, you won't amount to anything. You just won't. And I remember even the fucking teacher's name right now. Right now.
Wow.
You'll never amount to anything because you knew my sister, knew me, knew my house situation, my home situation. And they were the sort of comments. And my God, did it fucking drive me. There's just something, there's a fire in you. It's like, you watch me, fucker. You watch me rise. And even now, today, you know, I'm divorced. And I remember the fragmentation of your friends, right? You haven't been through it, but it's pretty ugly. You know, I don't know what people think, but they certainly side. They've got their own opinions. And even now I'm like, watch me. Watch me fucking go. Happy? Dude, I'm the happiest I've ever been. But they sort of have this kind of position that, oh, well, you should be regretful. So I actually use what you've just described there. Yes, I use it sparingly. I use it deliberately in a measured approach, a measured fashion. And yes, it pushes you for sure. But use it wisely.
We use it wisely. How do we switch out of it?
When you get the results, man, it starts to taper off.
Because
once the train's moving, you don't need that much coal, right? Once momentum's there, it doesn't matter. And the fucking proof just speaks volumes. Let them fucking pine. Let them scream. Let them carry on. There's so many naysayers in the world, and too many of us pay attention to that. Dude, this is your fucking time. This is your mission. Make it count. Don't listen.
Get up Tune and have a crack.
Out. Huh?
Get up and have a crack.
Oh, have a crack. Tune it out. It's irrelevant. It's just noise.
You were just talking about friend groups, and I've seen one of your other videos before talking about friend groups. Are you still friends with the same group of people since high school?
Definitely not, no.
None of them?
Couple, handful.
Yeah.
Yeah. But a lot of them fall away, you know. And that's okay. Your friendship circles really need to propagate. Mm. I'm always looking to tap into new circles.
So if I've got a group of friends right now that probably aren't serving me the best, how do you...
so personal, right? Hypothetically speaking, right?
Hypothetically speaking. Don't worry.
Like I'm Dr. Phil.
They wouldn't listen to this anyways. How would you go about... What would you do about that? Do you just spend minor time with minor people, or do you just go full ham and just cut them?
No,
or
respectfully. Just move away. Respectfully.
Yeah.
I don't even have them conversations where I'm like, you're out of my loop. I don't even have that. They just work it out. We're different.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as you start to, you know, you're a bit younger than me. As you start to create waves and your success is known, they become even more affected, more upset by that. You know, it's kind of funny. They look at you with a certain look, with a certain appearance, but behind your back, you know what's going on, and you know they're not good. You know you've got to get rid of them. They're toxic. Look, you know, as you start, and I think too, you know, in the world of business, as you start to shake a little and the numbers start to change and they start to rack up, you need to be reaching for new people in those circles. Because the only way you're going to elevate yourself is either fucking learning, podcast, read, or a combo of the both, of the two. Or the people around you. It's not science. It's not fucking rocket science. It's pretty simple. It's been the same for hundreds of years. So you need to be tapping into new circles. Now, today, that gets a bit harder because they're not that evident. And if they are, they're not that forthcoming with the information, the answers. Mm. It's a little more competitive. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But you've got to make a lot of effort, and I do that.
How have you gone about creating a new inner circle?
Yeah. Mate, I've been fortunate to shroud myself in some really key people. You know, a couple of those are billionaires and they've come through the commercial chain through my life, through work and business and enterprise. And a couple of those have come through social circles, which are big hitters, you know, major lenders, private lenders, things like that. And I will often want to be the dumbest person in the room.
How did you get into Keith Cunningham? And you spent a week with him.
I did, mate, yeah.
Is he the rich dad of Rich Dad Poor Dad?
He is the rich dad of Rich Dad Poor Dad, yeah. He's a cool cat. I've got a tip off. I won't tell you how it happened because it probably shouldn't have happened, but a friend of mine had access to someone that knows Keith really well. And they said to me, look, Keith's going to be overseas in this hotel at this particular time.
Wow.
And if you just randomly turned up, you might get to meet him. I'm getting goosebumps, dude. Yeah, and I fucking rolled up to Hawaii in the middle of nowhere, right? Fucking hotel, 11 o'clock at night, knowing he's going to land in the morning. He's private jet, he's PJ. And I just mysteriously fucking walk through breakfast and I'm like, I know his face. And that's exactly how it kicked off, yeah.
No way.
Yeah. Did you get to spend a week with him?
Yeah. Mate, he is such a gentleman.
Fuck.
A gentleman. Like, honestly, just a good, noble man. And he goes, yeah, he gets this Texan drawl. Yeah, no worries, dude. Yeah, you know. And tomorrow we'll meet up for some toast and some jam, you know. So that was the first morning. And we probably had 40 minutes. And he's so respectful. Like, his wife's there too. And I'm intruding on his breakfast, right? She's cool. She's on the phone, Sandy. And the next day, he's like, come back. Well, mate, I'm fucking there, you know. Bill paid the lot. Right, Keith? Definitely turns up on time, as he does. And we probably spent nearly an hour that day. And the day after was no different. We're out in the fire deck, on the waterfront, OJ, fucking breakfast. And he was just telling me about strategy. He said, this is how it started. And one of the greatest takeaways, and it's a fucking gift, is that I was moving in a circle then where I was making decent money. You know, I was doing projects all over Australia, Perth, North Melbourne, Brizzy, Greater Sydney. You know, I was making $7, $8, $9 million a year net, right? And he's like, you're just a monkey that's just busier than the rest.
Wow.
And I'm like, he's a fucking multi-billionaire, right?
Fuck.
And he's done everything, dude. You can talk to him about reverse mergers, exotic debt, this fucking debentures. Like, he's all over it, man. He just seems this simple, humble man. He's not, man. That guy's got so much depth, so much knowledge and wisdom, right? And I went, okay, cool. He goes, because you're still working for it. He goes, you tell me, young man. He goes, you pull up the stumps, you put up your boots, which is their cowboy boots, right? You pull up the boots, what happens? I said, well, the money stops. He goes, see? See? And I'm sitting there like I've interrogated. I'm like, I thought it's all fucking well. Like, you know, I'm killing it, right? And I wasn't. And then I came back, and it wasn't too long after that, I got the same thing. Life slapped me again. And I was sitting across the table from someone, you know, very significant. And it was almost the same conversation, but in different words, this fucking passive income thing. And I was making great money, but I was not being smart. I wasn't an investor.
Wow.
And that's the difference. That's the difference. You know, when you look at someone like him, it's done it. It's been to the bottom and the top a few times. They're the ones you can glean a lot from. So I came back and I changed the whole model. I was like, okay, I make really good money, but I'm not going to go back and invest it in the same shit I'm doing. I need to learn, diversify. What am I going to do? What's going to pay me when I'm not at work, when I'm not at the office? What does that look like? And I just went on a hunt. And probably 2.5 years later, I kept coming back to this industry called manufactured home parks. And it wouldn't leave me alone. It was like, there's something here. I own the land, and these people come along, put their house on my land to pay me a ground lease every week. Yes. And every time I scratch my head, I'm like, that seems lucrative. That seems lucrative. And I'd lived in the States for 2 or 3 years by that stage. And these trailer parks was the same concept, but just, you know, they're just not the most socially economic people, right? In Australia, it was different. They're called over 50s parks. And you don't have a lot of money. You're kind of a bit broke. You sort of, you know, you're retired. And the government was subsidizing your living expenses. And it made sense. And the more I looked into it, the more research I did, the more I sort of sounded that out with, you know, my team, accountants and things like that, the more it came back. It was like, yeah, that looks like it's going to work. So I bought a park and that went really well.
How long ago was that? The first one?
Oh, what was that? No, 6.5 years ago. What's that? 17, 16. Late 16, I put a contract. 2016, would have been October, November. I put a contract on a small park. I settled it in April.
Contract?
No, contract this time because I had, you know, I was making decent dough. I had to start putting it somewhere. And I did. It was about April. I settled on this park and it took off. And then I put another one on the contract, just kept buying and buying and buying. And they made sense. You know, they were making $500-800 million a year net after all expenses. And you had a manager, you had someone looked after the grounds, and they just kept paying this ground lease thing, you know? And if they didn't pay the ground lease, they had to move their home off your fucking land. So it was like, they'll find the rent, right?
Yeah.
And if they trash the house, I don't give a shit. It's your fucking house.
Yeah.
It's my land. But in 20 years' time, I can turn it into a land subdivision. I can sell it to bloody Fraser's, a high-rise site. Mm. I just had all these holdings all over the place that were paying more than their way.
Wow.
So, and that's what Keith did for me. You know, he really turned things for me. It was a 90-degree bend, that's for sure.
True.
Would you go residential property or something a bit more commercial scale like the park?
Yeah, look, manufactured home parks do fit under the commercial banner, and commercial lending applies to that segment. But if you said to me commercial property, it's a very broad topic. If you said to me retail or if you said to me office space, I'd run a mile. I would not get into those segments of real estate whatsoever. Office space, it's so funny. I remember post-COVID and all of the funds, all the REITs, real estate investment trusts, and all the big public companies, Mervac, Frasers, Stocklands, all of them, were chiming about how well their office assets were doing. Mm. And I was calling bullshit way back then and going, that's fucking rubbish. Susan Hurlitz, the CEO of Mervac's, jumping up and down saying the fucking foot traffic back to our malls is, you know, back to pre-COVID. And I was the only one saying, fucking bullshit. That's not true. That is fucking nonsense. And yeah, look now, look at the kind of the REITs. Look at the performance of REITs. Look at the valuations in the asset class of office space. Man, they're down 30%. So that business model is dying. It'll be extinct in our life people will work from home. There'll be no other alternative.
Mm,
yeah. It's more comfortable. It's more flexible. You spend more time with your family. I'm almost as productive, but fuck it, who cares? The boss doesn't know, right? We're all going to live under that guise, yeah?
Yeah.
And look, retail is the same. How long these malls continue, anyone's guess. 15 years, they're fucking done.
Mm.
It's cheaper online, it's faster. I have to worry about the car, parking, and to take the kids. Whenever I walk out of Coles, I spend $100 more than I need to. When I'm online, I'm more disciplined. And that's the future.
Yeah.
So I just think the future of real estate in those two particular segments, the opportunity for you and I, is how the fuck do we repurpose them? And there's some good ideas about that. I've got some great ideas cooking.
Where do you see this market going? Because obviously, I think, in my opinion, next year is going to be very turbulent. I'm not sure what you see across here, but in Sydney, we're dealing with a lot more distressed sellers coming to market.
No, sweetie, come on in. Sorry, guys.
That's all right.
Can Megan come in the pool with us? Megan? Yeah. My Megan? Of course you can. Hey, wait, over here. This is the reason you get out of bed, man. You got kids?
No.
Not yet.
You got kids?
No. 25.
Yeah, we've got a guest on the podcast today. Yeah. We've got a special guest.
You want to say hi?
Who do we have on today?
What's your name?
Jeter.
All right. Now.
Okay, you run.
Thank you for the cameo.
See you, sweetheart. You're awesome. See ya. Love you, baby girl.
That's precious.
That's awesome.
Oh, mate, that's the reason, isn't it?
That's your why.
That's the why, brother.
That's the why.
That's the why. You nailed it. Very well done. Good. Very observant of you. Well done.
Yeah, sorry. Coming back to the question, in Sydney, what I'm seeing in the residential marketplace, we're having a lot more distressed sellers coming to market.
Yeah.
There's a lot of financial stress at the moment with cost of living. People's mortgages have gone from $4,500 to $9,000 a month. People are struggling. Where do you see this market going next year?
How do you want me to play this?
Wherever you want.
Because you're a buyer's agency and you're okay. Because you live on both sides of the equation.
The truth.
Okay. Look.
Don't sugarcoat it.
Yeah, okay. No, because some people just go, oh, that's not what we want. Look, this doesn't play out well. We've been here before. It was called the GFC. And history repeats and people don't learn anything and it's a market of short corners. So what we're experiencing now, this is really quite troublesome. All the smart money's on the sidelines. All the guys that I mix shoulders with, rub shoulders with, you know, billionaires, there's nothing active. They're all just waiting, ready to pounce. I think that you and I have got some serious headwinds ahead of us. We've got a government that's asleep at the wheel.
Mm.
They keep writing checks, empty checks, which is diluting our currency. And it's going to happen fast. Interest rates are not anywhere near where they need to be. They're going to be in the early sevens, mid sevens before the next year. And I see delinquencies in mortgages at least 10, 12, 13%. Off an all-time low of 1.9. Can that happen all in the space of 3, 4 years? Fuck yes, it can. When you've got a government that doesn't know how to manage an economy, but plays to the masses, because that's exactly what we're doing here, there is no leadership. We're just going with the winds of that group, that cell. Let's listen to them. They're the greatest voting base. And governments, you know, politicians and MPs are all about, you know, rule one, stay in power. Rule two, go back to rule one. So it's not about the fucking people.
Mm-hmm.
And our economy is actually quite fragile. Oh, we're doing this and it's record fucking profits from Rio. Yeah, it's called mining. It's our only saviour. But our greatest demise will be that people can't own homes. And we're moving into that phase now.
You don't think there will be a major correction if this keeps happening? It's the way that I see it, and I could be wrong, but if everyone's going to be coming to market and having to force into selling their properties,
yes,
they're obviously going to have to sell lower to compete with other houses, right?
Most certainly.
So do you not think there'd be a major correction and then it would become more affordable?
Well, it's only affordable if you can afford to buy it.
Mm.
Mm. Now, when the tide goes out, everyone's exposed, right? Mm. It's an old saying. Mm. You talk to the cornerstones of money. When the tide goes, everyone's exposed. So when all prices roll back, so does appetite for lending.
Mm.
So bankers don't have capital and you will see a short credit market. So shit might be discounted by 10, 25%. I think that's quite possible. And I believe your theory to be true.
Hmm.
But you haven't been through a GFC, have you?
No.
All right. It's a bit of an age gap between us, respectfully.
Yeah.
Now, when the GFC hit, fucking banks just shut. It was 24 hours. If you didn't refi in 24 hours, you were out. He's got to ride it. It's fucking scary. So that sounds good in a perfect world, but yeah, you just can't borrow money. So you can see opportunities around, and this is where cash wins. You know, I remember buying a medical center. I bought a medical center, I think in 2009. Back then, 2.74 million was a lot of money, right? It was a fairly decent, sizable amount of medical center. Man, I bought it for 825 grand cash. Had a vowel of 2.7, went to auction, didn't get up. We knew it wouldn't. And the agent's ringing me. I'm on the way to training. And he's like, can you come and see this? And I'm talking across the bonnet of the truck. And I said, I'll give you 800 grand. He goes, it's a fucking insult. I wouldn't present that. I said, by law, you have to. He rang me that night and said, you're not going to believe this. They accepted 825 cash.
Wow.
Why? Because they owed Westpac 825, man.
No way.
So shit comes unraveled pretty quickly. But yeah, it's not a perfect world where credit's freely available.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Maybe a strategy to think about is, because you know, when things go bad, it's about who you know, not what.
Mm-hmm.
So a strategy for your listeners would be, who can I side with that's got deep pockets, that's a private or has got some money, some capital or a super fund that I can tap and give them returns? I can find the shit. I know it's going to be there. I'm willing to do the work. I won't sleep. But you're going to need cash to go into that cycle.
Yeah, I was thinking.
Does that make sense?
So hypothetically, how would someone like myself get in the room with someone like you for a week to get access to these types of funds?
Yeah, great question. Look, you've got to demonstrate ability. And people say, I don't have the experience. Well, go fucking get it.
Mm.
Go learn it, man. There's no more time in history where information has been more readily available. So there's got to be some credential, right? But to side up with a banker, a lender, a private money, a family office is not hard, because we're all looking to place capital, right? We're all looking to place capital. I'm always looking for opportunity. The more I got, the more opportunity I'm looking for. Mm. It's insatiable. Does that make sense? So you're always looking for opportunity, man. But someone, as you just said, that's got a little bit of skill and is willing to do the sweat equity, do the work and the yards, I'm going to back you. It's like, okay, what's the deal? Show me.
Mm.
What's in it? How does it look? What security is available? What's the period of lend? Okay. What's the upside? If shit goes bad, where are we left? Okay, that's a good exit. That's a good plan B. Mm. So getting that level of knowledge, getting that level of smarts about you, that's what it takes. And there's opportunity everywhere, mate. When you start siding with these people, I mean, I remember sitting across the table over a lunch one time with a billionaire, and he's like, we fucking like you. And his lawyer's there too, a guy called Alex. He goes, we fucking like you. I'm like, cool. He goes, the deals that you seem to bring just have honesty to them. And he's like 75 at this point. I say, okay. So honesty's important. He goes, well, you know, when I bounce you, you know, I look at your feasibility, your numbers. He goes, they're accurate. They're close to what we do. And we're always trying to be tricked. People, agencies walk through here all the fucking time with these cooked up fees. So there's plenty of money. And this guy just hammered me for the next year and a half. Find me this. It was like this fucking, you know, two-page mandate. Go get them and we'll pay you for them. Sweet. I sat down at my office with a couple of guys and went, right, we're fucking on this. You're doing this. Let's just find this shit. And they're the veins of gold, the seams of gold. So have the expertise. You're not going to get it from uni. Mm. Learn it, work it, do the hard yards.
So you were kind of working as a buyer's agent.
I had so many ultimate buyers, they were just desperate to place capital. You know, and developers aren't the smartest bunch, but they've got money, right?
They do have money.
And for me, I was like, what do you want? I need a fucking 1,000 blocks in 1,000 lot of state. No dramas, I'm your guy. I'd fly across the country 15 fucking times until I came back and said, that's you. That's the one you want, right? Yeah. Can you do some due diligence? Yeah, I'll give you 60 days. Put some money down. And yeah, that's what we did.
Wow.
We just assembled deals. So,
that's cool.
And most of it, look, you know, looking back over my shoulder, most of it was sort of residential. Probably 65, 70% of it was resi. And the other part was sort of more about shopping and retail, you know, sort of, yeah, high traffic commerce. Nothing in the office space and nothing in industrial.
Wow. Could you share your favourite deal story?
Yeah, sure. If you don't it was mind. A park I bought years ago. And and you don't know until you ask, right? I got a tip off, and parks aren't easy to find, but I got a tip off from a person that a park might be for sale. And it had a lot of potential. It was a small park when I bought it, but it had a lot of potential. The DA for this and a DA for that, and a fucking development permit for this. And the property was over three titles. They were about 14 hectares in total. Like it was on a highway. It had a mixed bag. Like you do what you want, right? And I got this tip off one day and I said, look, you know the guy? He goes, yes, I do. Yes, he's Sydney based. I said, okay, great, let's go see him. Oh, I better make sure it's okay first. I'm like, what's going on? Oh, he's a bit of a shady character. I said, all right, okay. He goes, just be prepared if he does agree to meet us, it could be a bit weird. I go, okay. We turn up in this little fucking house, windows drawn, curtains, smoking like a banshee. I'm like, all right, something's up. Just, you know, I'm getting a read on the situation. And a corporate, one of my competitors in the park space, had put a contract on this property for $4.9 million, but couldn't get it approved through the board because of all these different details and DAs for this and permits for that. The board just likes simple vanilla deals. So I'm sitting across the table from this guy and he kept smoking and he's swearing and he still looks stressed. And I looked at this guy that knew him and I'm like, all right, so what's the situation? Like, I'm here to buy. I've heard the story. Your missus this, your business partner that, fucking NAB is this. Give me the lowdown. Like, I just conclude for me, because he was just erratic, right? And he goes, well, I owe all this money and rah, 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 fucking this and that too, and there's this other fucking thing that, you know, I owe. And I said, all right, so can I just start? Just help me out here. Pin down a number. Like, if you're selling it, you're going to solve all these problems. What's the number? He goes, $4 million. And I said, nah, I'm not even close to that. I said, this thing's got so much trouble. I've rang the council and you've got a court case with the council. He looks down, starts puffing away again. I said, you threatened them with a subpoena. Yeah, you could see his eyes getting a bit red. He's like fucking angry. I'm like, oh, okay. And I said, and they were expected to be at Supreme Court, the whole council. There was a busload of them and you didn't turn up. He goes, yeah, fuck them. I went, righto, we can do something here, right? It's, I'm siding with the villain. Okay, all right. And we're au fait. We're pretty familiar with council processes, right? I've been working with them for a decade and a half of my life. And I said, okay. I said, listen, I'm not here to offend you. I'm a buyer today. It's exactly what I said. I looked across the table and I said, listen, I'll give you 500 grand for it. And I thought he was going to jump out of the lounge and fucking hit me. I did. And Jason, the guy beside me, is just gone. And he's this fucking, you know, he was so irate. He reaches across, gets a cigarette in South Australia, and goes, 500 fucking thousand. I'm like, all right, it's on. I'm like, we're going to get fucking beat now. He goes, I'll ring my missus. He picks up the phone, walks out in the veranda with his cigarette, and he goes, listen, we owe money on this fucking water purification unit too. What's that? And she goes, 25 grand. He walks back and he goes, 525. And I looked at Jason and I went, okay, yes. He goes, righto, hangs up the phone, walks back in, sits down. And I said, Jason, get a fucking contract, whatever you do. So it was 4.9, it was 525 cash.
God damn.
Settled in 48 hours. And mate, this thing was a fucking screamer. It was already making 200 grand a year in profit.
Oh, that's mental. That is so mental.
200 a year in profit, and I had fucking 13 hectares or something, and DAs for this, and there's a fucking shop down the front, cafe, zoning of this. I had water permit lease things from DNR. Like, it was nuts. It was fucking crazy. Had a DA for another 182 homes. Can you believe it? No infrastructure, but had a DA for 182 additional homes in the manufactured home park, and it was a dream deal. So sometimes I think it's important that you know what you're talking about. Mm. And that comes with experience. Experience comes from making mistakes, sadly. But that was a good deal. There's been many like that.
Wow. How did you know to pick 500,000?
Oh, look.
Intuition at that point?
No, maybe call intuition. It was just when he started to talk about the war with council, there was no way out. There was no way they were going to let him operate the park, and he had no money, and he owed NAB all this cash. And NAB was going to repossess it. They were going to do an MIP, mortgage in possession. So I'd already done some research on that. I'd done some research on the council. And there was no way out for the poor guy. And 500 now was going to solve the problems. In fact, it gave him the benefit of living another day because he had some properties in Western Sydney that were about to get repossessed. Had he have not cleared this thing off the register, they were going to take the whole lot.
Wow.
So he actually gave him some time. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It was so smart. He owed them about 500 Gs.
I have to ask, what was it like buying your first supercar?
Speaking of time, I see TD, time deposit dollars.
Yeah, nice. Good observation, yeah. The first supercar, yeah, good, really good. Yeah, way back, man. I bought a Porsche 911 S. Yeah. That was a big deal, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I'd done some transactions, made some money. I paid off some debt. And I used to have this smart ass at the Porsche dealership, Michael Bollard. I hope he's listening. I was the guy to walk up the glass like every other week, you know? Be looking at the cars, and I knew all the models and the color codings and the combinations of upholstery. He's like, "Oh, you're back again." Yeah, I'm back again, you know? And he looked slick, he was a few years older than me, just a little smart ass. He looked down his nose and be like, "Oh, yeah, you know, whatever." And he just gave up talking to me. And then I remember one day distinctly, the money was in the bank. I banked $1,066,000 out of a deal, cash. And I was like, fuck it, I'm going to go back and find that guy. And the first time I turned up to Porsche, he wasn't there. Oh, he's on day off. I'm like, great, when's he back? Oh, Thursday morning. I'll be fucking here. Don't you worry about that. And I wore my daggy shit in, same sort of look, same appeal. And he's sitting behind the glass and he's laughing and he's doing this. And I kept walking up and down like 14 fucking times, just planting the bait, right? Just giving him the carrot. And he finally walks up towards the doorway and said, "Hey, Michael." He goes, "Yeah." I said, "Yeah, that Arctic Silver Porsche you've been talking about." He goes, "Yeah." I said, "I'll take it." He looks at me and he goes, "How do you plan to pay for it?" I said, "Do you pay in cash? Do you take cash?" And he just looked at me. Shit was different, right? And then he looked at me again. He said, "Come to the desk." Sat down. He sort of really started to qualify me. "You're paying in cash?" I said, "Yeah, the whole lot." "Yeah. Do you take bank checks?" And he just, we do. "Lucy, can you give me coffee? Lucy, this is a special treatment." And yeah, I think about 3 weeks later it turned up. 3.5 weeks later it turned up.
Wow.
Arctic Silver. Yeah, it was really fucking mean. And getting in that car was kind of special, man.
Yeah.
The smell of the leather was just so overpowering. New. It was pretty sweet.
Do you still get that same feeling when you buy a car, or buy a supercar
these
days?
I don't know about that. Yeah, I was a very visual person. Careful, Kevin. No, I actually don't, sadly.
Yeah.
No. I got that same rush, though, a while back when I bought my helicopter.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you move on. We talked about this before. You know, I think evolution in life is more about progression. It's about, you know, moving on. And a car shouldn't have the same effect. Because, you know, the kind of man that it took to achieve that car is not the same man that shows up and buys a fucking super yacht, right? Mm. It should be a different personality, a different persona, a different character. And I remember buying the helicopter. It was a big deal. I transferred the money. And my lawyer was going, "We don't do helicopters." I said, "Yeah, I know." We looked at the contract. I said, "Yeah." He goes, "I feel really nervous." He said, "Have you seen it?" I said, "No." He goes, "Where is it?" I said, "In Perth." "Oh. You're going to transfer a couple of million?" I said, "Yeah, yeah." "You got the logbooks?" I said, "Yeah, it's all fucking here. Like, the mechanics have been through it. The technician." "Oh, okay, all right. When are you going to go pick it up?" I said, "Next week." And he was just so skeptical. And I remember the transfer and he sent me the receipt. I got that same rush, like that first love of, wow, we got a fucking helicopter. How cool is this, right?
Wow. Yeah.
That's sick.
And then they said to me, "We can take the rotors off and put on a truck for you." I said, "Fuck that. I'm going to fly it back to Queensland." They looked at me like, "You're going to what?" I said, yeah, I'm going to take my instructor. I'm going to fly all the way back to Queensland." And 3.5 days later, it turned up. It was fucking cool.
That's sick.
Wow. So cool.
That's so sick.
Mate, I was flying 9 hours a day. I learned fast everything, every different airport you can imagine, every approach profile. It was great.
That is sweet.
So the rush is still there. I'm in the process of buying another vessel. I'm really into boats, super yachts, you know?
Yeah, so you sold one, right?
I sold one not so long ago, yeah. Yeah, because of COVID, you know, it's a four-year build period. So people are just offering you telephone numbers for boats, existing stock.
Yeah.
So I actually sold the boat for much more than I bought it for.
Wow.
I had it for 5.5 years, man. I put 1,000 hours on it, right?
Take that.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you've got to step out, right? So it's been a bit hard to find something to get back into. But I've recently located something in Aussie. It's a one-of, and it's an Italian build. It's a pretty significant boat. It's in the teens, millions. And just recently, I've had another offer on all my home parks.
Oh, wow.
The whole lot. So just combined. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to buy a new fucking boat. When these dudes transact, I'm going to sell out. I'm going to fucking go get myself a new boat.
Hell yeah.
Lord, yeah. So
we'll do part two on the boat.
Yeah, dude. Yeah.
Is part three on the PJ or?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, PJs you don't use that much. Mm. You know, I've got one of those programs where you throw in a couple hundred grand and you get really, really cheap air travel per hour, right? And I just don't see the point in tying up five, six, six and a half in a PJ. Mm. I've got two other mates. They've all said the same thing. Let's go in. And we looked at the numbers and the math don't really work. Unless you've got 25 hours a month of charter, it doesn't make any sense. You're better off just going, hey, you know, I'm with Airly. So Luke's in charge of that. He's the owner. Like, Luke, just give me a fucking plane. We're here, here, here. Yeah, no problem. I mean, it's like $3,800 an hour, you know, for a seven-seater. Dude, that's an $8 million aircraft. And it's going to cost me 70, 90 grand a month to hold it. Oh, yeah. Makes no sense at all. $3,700, you know, for an hour. So I don't know that a PJ is a burn for me.
Yeah.
Mm. They're cool. They look cool. I don't do that much travel, given my little girl. I'm based deliberately here. So I don't see the real need.
My last question for you would be, what would be your advice to anyone that is struggling with cash right now?
Yeah, great question.
Because I know that's going to take a big mental toll on you. What do you suggest?
That's a great question, man. I mean, I think a lot of people go through financial hardship in a very different way. You know, Mark Burris said it really well a couple of months ago. He said, one of the worst parts of the 1980s crash, when interest rates hit 16%, he said that people like me were forced to sell houses and go bankrupt. He said, but they'll never re-enter the market. And that's the tragedy that we face right now. So whoever gets tipped out, and there'll be a large proportion of that, somewhere between about 8 and 11% of current homeowners will never get back in the cycle again. They'll never own a home. That's a big number. That's a vast sum. Yeah. And I can see that. Burris is spot on. He's a legend. Yeah. He's fucking spot on.
Yeah.
So what do they do for cash and they're against the wall now? Cut up fucking credit cards. It's the fastest way to save yourself is to hang on to disposable cash. Mm. Oh, that sounds so easy. Yeah, no, mate, just take a knife to everything. Mm. Cards, don't need it. Clothes, fucking don't care. Mm. Eat out, no. Booze, nah, I'm going to go dry anyway. I should, right? Mm. Sacrifice. And it's got to be serious. Mm. It's not like, oh, yeah, but we'll go camping, you know, next month with the friends down the street. It's only going to cost us $800, you know, for a week. Just cut everything. Mm. Cut it all. Get serious. And then double down with your income.
Yeah.
Because we've got an unemployment crisis right now. You cannot get employees, right? So go work fucking Saturday, Sunday, mate. Mm. Go hang out with your mate. There's a roof tiler. Make $450 cash for the day. Fuck, I'm in. Mm. That's how you turn around. It's a double-edged sword. Cut costs and then boost your income. And use the time you've got now. Because no one's working hard, man. Let's face it.
Yeah.
Post-COVID, no one's doing 70-hour weeks. No. There is a handful. But to sell a Saturday just to get ahead for the short term, that's intelligent.
Yep. Beautiful. Thank you.
For my last question, should we talk about the story of you buying this house about or your experience doing the Sahara Desert run or the biggest, not trauma, but the biggest challenge you've had to overcome, whether it be entrepreneur or personally?
That's a good one. Depends how you want to steer it. Do you want to steer it towards more the benefit of entrepreneurship or you want to steer it towards mental health? Because you both made that point coming in.
What do you feel resonates well at the moment?
I think the conversation on everyone's lips is mental health.
Mm. Let's go with that.
Yeah. All right.
If you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. Look, I'd say the greatest challenge that I've had to succumb to would be my divorce.
Mm.
Because business is a funny thing. If you are willing and able and prepared, you'll make it. Oh, it's luck. No, it's not fucking luck. You work for luck.
Mm.
You make opportunity. There's so many books that sort of that chime the same soundings, yeah? But when something hits you personally, that's a different category. And as men, we're not wired as well as women dealing with emotions. We're not. we don't have that cachet, that deep understanding of how I feel. And there's a reason for that. You know, for hundreds of years, men have been trained to bring home the bacon, suck it up, go make the fucking money, bring it home. So it's not that we're not emotional. We've just been very good and trained in the modern day to not listen to the fucking emotions. So when a woman sort of criticizes a husband, he doesn't fucking open up, he doesn't know how to communicate. Mm. Yeah, that's his training. That's not his character. Mm. We've been forced into that world. Mm. So you and I are a little unequipped. We're a little bit light on Mega Drive, you know? So going into a divorce for me was not an easy task. You know, my wife decided to end the marriage, which is completely fine. It's her choice. Oh. I can't be an easy person to live with, right? I'm sure of that. But, yeah, dealing with that and processing that and being conscious of my daughter was a tough one. So, yeah, some very dark days and some things I'm not proud of. But I must admit, you know, throughout it all, there was an inner knowing that I'd come out of it. Not nice, not pleasant. The furnace was fucking hot. It was hot. And I'm taking a beating, you know, like, you know, we weren't married that long, but she had an idea that she was going to take me for everything. That was the plan. And I got nothing against her. I think if I look back, quite frankly, I think a lot of it had to do with her surroundings, the people around her. Hmm. The women around her were like, right, this is your last fucking paycheck. Make it happen.
Wow.
And take him out. And that was pretty evident. So to get back to the point, I think it's critical to understand that you're going to have some really fucking tough times. But, you know, you need to lean into either those around you or try and open up the best you possibly can. We're not equipped like they are, but it's important that you try and, yeah, at least understand what the fuck's going on. This is what's happening in my head. Is that normal? And I would discourage the use of substance and alcohol. I went pretty rampant on the booze, and that didn't serve anybody. And I think I was very fortunate that I've always been quite fit and trained and rode as a kid. But yeah, I think that didn't help me at all. Mm. That just muddied the waters, and I didn't really see it. It was like a great out. It'd be like, fuck it. I'm taking 80 emails a day. Apparently I'm hiding money in the fucking Seychelles. Now I'm hiding money in fucking Geneva, Switzerland. There was just constant noise. And I think the stress and the pressure of that forced me into that place. I could have made better decisions. Make sense?
Hmm.
And I think I would have arrived at a better place sooner had I have not just taken the easy way and just get smashed. So I'd say to anybody, you know, be alert that those temptations, those distractions are there. We all make choices. And I'm not your fucking father. I'm not trying to preach. But I'm just saying it's definitely a better route if you're sober and you're fucking on it.
Yeah.
You know? Agreed. We've all had people pass away. I think awake is a stupid idea. Let's get fucking boozed.
Yeah, fucking right.
And the emotions run fucking crazy, right? Listen, you know, in due respect of Arnie, you know, Mavis, Arnie, Rebecca, let's go to the beach. Let's go here. Let's go do something. Mm. Let's go fucking play bocce. Have a laugh,
but
let's not get fucking wasted, shall we? There's better decisions to be made.
Yeah.
And they're not always the easiest.
Mm. Mm. I appreciate you opening up about it because it's very relevant for everyone that it's an incident like that, and not many are equipped with tools to help them through that. Like, what's an activity or a strategy to get back to presence and feel yourself again? And
well, you actually touched on it before, strangely. It's your friends. It's their camaraderie. It's going back to that.
Yeah.
That's the saving grace. You try and do it alone, you'll come undone. You become unraveled. And it's hard to stop. Because when it becomes unraveled, it's just the next booze, next bottle, next bag, whatever it might be, whatever your choice is. But I think you need that camaraderie around you at those times.
Mm.
You can lean into those and someone that really knows you well. Yeah, and is willing to go through it. And we've all got that person. There's always someone in your corner. Mm. Lean on them. Yeah.
Mate, thank you so much. That was
insane. Legendary.
Phenomenal.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Anytime, man. Here to help.
Wow.
Go.
Wow.